I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Ukrainian forces were greeted as liberators last week as they took back the city of Kherson following the withdrawal of Russian forces. Earlier this fall, President Putin had announced that Kherson and three other Ukrainian provinces belong to Russia. Ukrainian President Zelensky visited the city yesterday to celebrate the victory, calling it a historic day and the beginning of the end of the war. We are now learning about what 8 months of Russian occupation was like for the residents of Kherson, with reports of torture, arbitrary arrests, beatings, and disappearances. Meanwhile, the war drags on. Today, Russia fired missiles into Kyiv, hitting two residential buildings. We begin with Jeffrey Gettleman. He's Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent, and he's been covering the war in Ukraine since the Russian invasion for the New York Times, and he joins us from Kherson. And Jeffrey Gettleman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. I'm happy I have a signal. It's been difficult all day communicating.
I know. We were tracking you down all morning, and I'm glad we were able to connect. So we will just cross our fingers that we can ask you several questions. First of all, describe the city of Kherson for our listeners. What does it look like?
Okay, so I'm standing on a rooftop right now, and it's about 5 o'clock, and it's pitch black. There are very few lights on in this entire city of a couple hundred thousand people. I'm just looking across dark rooftops, dark yards, a few flickering fires that people have made to cook their food. And it's really striking that you're in such a big place and there's no electricity, no running water, no heat in the homes. It's already below freezing. And there's this sense of pride and joy and victory that after all these long fights and after all these months of waiting for the Ukrainians to come and liberate the city, that's happened. But now we're beginning to get a sense of the aftermath and how bad that occupation was and how traumatic it was and what people experienced. And the stories are beginning to come out because there are no Russians here anymore, and finally people are free to talk.
In fact, your most recent article is about what some of the residents of Kherson have been telling you about what life was like under Russian occupation. I talked about the fact that there were arbitrary arrests and torture, beatings, disappearances, absolutely horrifying. Are the residents, now that there are no Russian forces there, are they enthusiastic to tell a reporter what it was like for them?
Well, I think it was really bad, and I think people do want to share the stories because they want the world to know what they experienced and what they suffered. But I got the sense that the Russians, as time passed, the Russians became harsher and the behavior worsened, and we heard more reports. You know, they came in into Kherson in the very beginning of the war. The first few days, the Russians moved out of the Crimean Peninsula and took this city, which is a major city in Ukraine, without any resistance. The Ukrainian forces had just pulled back because they wanted to defend other cities like Kyiv, the capital. So the Russians walked in here on February 24th, the first day of the war. And I think it was pretty quiet at the beginning. There wasn't too much resistance. People were waiting and seeing what was going to happen. But as the summer progressed and as the Ukrainian forces got stronger and began to put a lot of pressure on this city, coming in from all these different directions, blowing up bridges, attacking Russian troops that were posted in the villages outside of the city, the behavior inside Kherson got really bad. And we heard stories of people being beaten up on the streets for no reason, put in the hospital, punched in the face repeatedly and really badly hurt. We heard about people that were taken away from their families and taken to underground torture chambers and interrogated and tortured with electricity and beaten with sticks and really badly hurt or even killed. We've heard lots of stories like this. And also what's interesting is even now, we're now almost, it's been almost a week or 5 or 6 days since the Russians left. There are still billboards all across the city that the Russians had put up, that the Russian government had put up, convincing the people of Kherson that they were Russian, that they should stick with Russia, that Russia was their motherland. And so it's really spooky to see how hard the Russians tried to own this place. And very few people bought it. And the resistance was widespread and deeply felt.
Well, as you have written, you could get arrested for mentioning Ukraine or referencing a national song or speaking Ukrainian, or if there was Ukrainian being taught in schools. Obviously, there was an attempt to try to erase anything of Ukraine that was part of Kherson. You also interviewed an extraordinary woman, a kindergarten teacher, who was absolutely defiant of what the Russians were doing there. Tell us about her.
Well, what you said about trying to erase Ukrainian nationality and erase like a sense of being Ukrainian is exactly what they were trying to do. And this one teacher, her name was Olena, a 57-year-old kindergarten teacher. She spent her entire life with little kids in schools. And when the Russians came in, she said she felt this sense of anger way deeper than she ever expected. And she started making TikTok videos celebrating Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian patriotism. And these videos were really well liked. Some of them were watched like 300,000 times. And this woman wasn't a celebrity. She was just an ordinary teacher in this town. And that went on for a long time. She got a good reputation among the people of the city of really standing up for being Ukrainian. And then in August, these soldiers came to her house. They banged on the door. They pointed their guns at her, and they took her away. And they brought her to an underground torture chamber, and they beat her, and they threatened to kill her, and they threatened to put things inside her body, and they were really brutal. And they kept her there for 11 days, and when they released her, they said, "We're going to kill you if you say anything," and they really traumatized her. And I caught her, this is totally by chance, I came into Kherson yesterday for the first time, and I was in the town square just meeting people who had all come out, flags on their backs, waving signs, and I see this one woman walking through the square, and everybody's hugging her. And I asked somebody, I was like, "Who's that?" And they're like, "That's one of like our best bloggers, and she was taken into detention, and we're really just surprised and stunned that she's still alive."
You talk about, you know, the trauma. On the one hand, the heroism, the courage, the determination to prevail in their city. On the other hand, are we talking, though, about a traumatized city or a city of traumatized people?
I think that's totally the case. And this is what happened in Bucha. I was covering the atrocities that unfolded in this town, Bucha, just north of Kyiv, where the Russians occupied it for about a month in the month of March, early on in this war. And as they were leaving, they just started massacring people. And they shot people in the head, and they left bodies in the street. And there was no rhyme or reason that we could ever figure out of, like, why they killed the people that they killed. But they left hundreds of people dead in the streets. And so when they left, there was this sense of liberation, of freedom, just a sense almost of relief that these monsters are no longer around us. But then people start digesting what happened, and they start sharing accounts of war crimes and crimes against humanity and atrocities. And it's just, it's as a journalist, it's just really hard to listen and to absorb this without feeling helpless, because these people will tell you these stories about these horrible things that happened to them, and there's nothing we can do. We can't bring back their loved ones. We can't take away those horrible memories. We can't restore their trust in fellow human beings. And it's the same here. We don't know how bad it is. It's just a few days that this city has opened up, and there's very little communication. So it's hard to meet people. It's hard to connect. The cell phone service doesn't work. There's no electricity. So you have a lot of people that are moving around this city that are trying to get in touch with friends or loved ones, and it's really difficult. So I think as the days go on, we're going to have a better appreciation and maybe a sadder and more tragic understanding of what happened.
Well, you should know, Jeffrey, that you are telling their stories, and we are reading about them. And so the word is getting out, and that is so important. Where are the Russian troops that were in Kherson? I was reading that they're sort of across the river, not far from Kherson.
Exactly. So I'm standing on a rooftop. It's very difficult finding a place to stay in Kherson, because most of the hotels are shut, and it's just a complicated thing just trying to come into a city that has so few services. And I'm standing on this hotel right now, and I'm looking out across the river, and the Russians withdrew maybe 10 or 15 miles away. But every few minutes you hear these booms of artillery. I heard one right before you guys called. And the Russians are still firing toward us. And yesterday when I was on a trip with a bunch of journalists, there was explosions just a few hundred meters from where we were stopped on the road. And we heard this whistle and then this huge boom and saw this black smoke boiling up from these fields that weren't that far away. So there's still like a lot of fear in the air, even though they're not physically in front of us in Kherson. The Russian troops are not that far away. And there's even fears that they could begin shelling the city now that their forces have left and just level it with artillery. And I don't know if that sounds so sinister, and maybe that won't happen, but a lot of people here are really worried about that.
Jeffrey, a lot has been made about the Ukrainian winter. As you said, you were there from the beginning of the invasion, the attack by Russia, which, of course, was the end of February. Help us understand, what is a Ukrainian winter like?
The Ukrainian winter is really long. It starts in October, and it goes till like the end of March. So basically half of their year is pretty cold. And it gets quite cold in parts of Ukraine. Minus 20 Celsius, which is, you know, close to zero or even less than that in Fahrenheit. And so now everybody's trying to get in position for what happens when it gets really cold. People are stocking up on firewood. They're trying to get their hands on warm clothes. They're trying to fix broken windows. I did a piece in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about the national shortage of glass in Ukraine. Something so simple that we take for granted. They don't have much of it in Ukraine at all, and there's been millions of windows that have been shattered by bombs across this entire country. And as winter comes and the cold air begins to blow in, people are furiously trying to fix up their houses to keep, you know, some heat inside. So there's just a lot of difficulties here. I mean, there's the bigger picture of what happens. You know, is there going to be peace? Is this war going to go on? What happens to the economy? Can people go back to their normal lives? But then there's just practical problems like no electricity, no running water, no heat, no glass. And you meet people today. I went to a distribution of humanitarian aid, and a truck came and delivered water. And we were talking to one woman who had just taken some because she had no water in her house. And she just broke down and started crying and said, you know, I just like have been keeping all this sadness inside me. And now I can finally drop my guard and let it out. And she told us this story that the first Ukrainian soldier she saw come into Kherson outside of her apartment building, she went outside and she said to him, "Can I just hold your hand for a minute? Because that will make me feel better."
Jeffrey,
I know I start crying.
I know. It's
really moving.
It is very moving and very important that we hear these stories. Can you stay with us for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Hold on. That's Jeffrey Gettleman, and he's joining us from Kherson in Ukraine, describing the city, describing conversations he's having with residents there who managed to survive Russian occupation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jeffrey Gettleman. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent. He's been covering the war in Ukraine since the Russian invasion back in February for the New York Times, and joining us from a rooftop in Kherson in Ukraine. Jeffrey, just a couple of questions before we have to say goodbye to you. Are there parts of the country that have been untouched by this now 9-month war?
There are a few parts in western Ukraine that have been relatively spared. They have not been too heavily hit by missile strikes. There's never been any Russian forces there. Life there is somewhat normal. But let me add, this war has touched every single Ukrainian in the country, and so many who've been sent out by trying to flee with their families. So many people have been called up to service. So many people know relatives and have friends who have been hurt or have had their homes destroyed. And everything has been disrupted. There's no, for instance, there's no flights into Ukraine. The airspace is totally closed. So for anybody who wants to come in and work here or visit, you have to go to Poland or Moldova and take a long road trip in. There's no, there's no, none of the men in Ukraine are allowed to leave. There's a law saying no men is allowed, of military age, can leave the country. The economy has been really heavily hit. It's just like one problem after another. So even if there's a part of the country that hasn't tasted the conflict directly, it's still been impacted.
What do Ukrainians say about their President Zelensky?
I think most people are behind him. You really do not hear much negative criticism, any type of criticism. It's just a moment of intense nationalism. I've never witnessed a place where everybody is on the same page the way they are here. I mean, just about everybody believes this war is worth fighting for to the very end. Just about everybody believes they're going to win. And just the willingness to make sacrifices, to live in a city where there's no electricity or water or heat, to join the military even if you have no military experience, to see your friends getting cut down by a bigger and better armed force without questioning that. That's what I'm sensing and feeling everywhere I go in this country.
Final question. You mentioned better armed force. From your perspective, is Russia better armed than Ukraine?
So everything I've heard from soldiers on the front line is the Russians have 10 to 20 times as much artillery. They have more guns. They have more tanks. But it's not making a huge difference because the will to fight and the morale just isn't there on the Russian side. And the discipline of the troops and the way they've just been sort of thrown into this conflict and scattered across the country without a really clear strategy. We saw that in the beginning of the war where the Russians sent this 20-mile-long column of tanks and armored personnel carriers and artillery pieces steaming towards the capital, Kyiv, and it got nowhere. It just seems like the Ukrainians are fighting this underdog war with such gusto and such determination that they're able to stand up to a bigger and, you know, maybe on paper, stronger enemy. And we'll see what happens. I mean, there's still a lot of Russian troops here and in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas area, which has always been a place that's been conflict-ridden, and it's been basically at war since 2014. The Russians are still advancing. So it's different things are happening in different parts of this country. But where I am right now, there's just a sense of relief that people can be free and that they don't have to worry about getting beaten up or abducted or abused by some foreign occupier.
Jeffrey Gettleman, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your reporting from Ukraine. Really, really appreciate it.
Hey, I'm really happy I could come on the show.
Yeah,
thanks.
Us as well. And again, a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for The New York Times has been covering the war in Ukraine since the Russian invasion. We have been talking about what has transpired in the city of Kherson in Ukraine. Again, talking with our guest, Jeffrey Gettleman, a significant setback for Vladimir Putin in his 9-month war against Ukraine. While residents celebrated their liberation, we learned that they also revealed the horror of living under Russian occupation with stories of beatings and torture, disappearances and death. Much of the city has been destroyed. Most of the residents have fled. While Ukrainian President Zelensky called this defeat a historic day, the war drags on. The winter fast approaching. There are concerns about access to heat, electricity, and water, as we heard, and also worries about the prospect of troops fighting in the bitter cold. So what does the withdrawal from Kherson mean for Ukraine and for Russia? What is Putin planning in his military as his military continues to suffer losses on the battlefield? How long will the U.S. and our allies support Ukraine's war efforts, and what are the prospects for diplomacy and a negotiated peace? We have two guests who have joined us. Dara Masico is senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. She was previously senior analyst for Russian military capabilities at the Department of Defense. And Dara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And we just lost our other guest, but we're going to get him back with us. But let me begin with you, Dara. As you listen to Jeffrey Gettleman describing what happened in Kherson, what is the significance of what happened, at least militarily?
It's really just incredible to listen to his firsthand accounts of meeting with people and what they've suffered under occupation. And, you know, despite the rhetoric out of Moscow, Kherson is a Ukrainian city. They are not part of the Russian Federation. It's just these accounts are just incredible. From a military perspective, it does seem that Russia has recently completed a controlled retreat from the western or the northern bank of the Dnipro River and moved its forces across to the eastern side, where I think it will probably reallocate them elsewhere along the front line.
And when you describe about Russian forces, what are we talking about? How big? What kind of, you know, what kind of weapons do they have? How have they been fighting this war in this region of Kherson?
Sure. So the forces that were formerly on the western side of that bank were some of Russia's most elite units, coming from their airborne forces, some of their ground forces units that were not destroyed in the opening phases of the war up near Kyiv were actually relocated to that region earlier this summer. The Ukrainians were discussing a counteroffensive down near Kherson. Russia moved a lot of forces across the side of that river. I think probably estimates were in the low thousands. I've seen it range up to 20,000. So there's a bit of a discrepancy there in terms of how many were there. But in around July or late August, the Ukrainians were able to use Gimlers and using the HIMARS systems to destroy most of the bridges behind the Russians, essentially trapping them there. And Russia really did not have an ability to continue to supply those forces. They were ferrying them across in riverboats, trying to create floating bridges. It was just really an untenable position for the Russians after about early September. So the decision that they made in starting in October to pull them back was a decision rather than face encirclement or being captured or killed, to have a controlled egress or withdrawal from the region.
You mentioned a couple of weapons that the Ukrainian forces were using. Are we talking about airborne weapons? Is that how this is being fought, at least military to military?
Well, I think down in that region, there was a few different things going on. So the accounts from the Ukrainian soldiers were saying that the Russian army units or the Russian airborne units that were on that part of the western bank were actually dug in pretty well. They had a lot of time to dig positions. They had multiple defensive lines. The Ukrainians were reporting that it was very difficult to engage with them. And I think they took a lot of casualties fighting for that area. But really the most damaging thing for the Russians, I think, came from those precision strikes on the bridges. They had no real ability to continue to reinforce that position. So I think it was a combination of that frontal engagement and then also the precision fires behind the Russian positions.
And this is a very significant part of Ukraine for Russia, correct?
It is. And leaving this territory really signals the end right now for Russia's ability to try to push further west. That was, of course, part of their initial invasion plan, that they would go as far as Odessa and essentially cut off Ukraine from having any type of seaborne marine transit for their economy. That's essentially over now. They just simply don't have the ability to ever try to push back that far west on current path anyway.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dara Masiko. And again, she's senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, previously senior analyst for the Russian military capabilities at the Department of Defense. We have another guest that we are trying to connect with. But in the meantime, many questions for our guests, and I'm sure you have them as well. You can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Dara, before this war, the Russian military was often described, as the second most powerful military after the United States. Can we still say that?
I've seen that phrase. The second best army. That's not one that I used or that a lot of my colleagues use. So I think that phrase is being used now. But I don't know that it would. Those are words that I would have used prior to the war. But certainly there's a lot of perceptions that and our understanding of the Russian military is shifting in real time. So, there were structural problems before the war where, you could look at what their manpower situation was. You could look at the force strength that they had. And in late 20, 2021, when the Russian war plan was essentially in American press on the front page, it didn't make a lot of sense. It just wasn't enough ground forces to do what they were aiming to do in the beginning. But as soon as they found themselves in this high-intensity, protracted war, all of these issues that they'd been papering over in peacetime really came to light. All the corners that they cut on maintenance, all the corners that they cut on training, all the corners that they were cutting on their manning levels in their units. They just didn't have people in military billets, and they were just glossing over that because it was peacetime, they weren't at war, or the oversight was very bad.
Dara, we do have Andrew Weiss joining us now, and he is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of a book titled Accidental Tsar, The Life and Lies of Vladimir Putin, and it is a graphic novel biography of the Russian leader. Andrew Weiss, I'm glad you could join us. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's so great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And I've been talking with Dara Masico about the Russian military and what we have been seeing related to the fighting in and around Kherson, but also other parts of Ukraine as well. Let me just ask you about the significance of the fact that Russian troops withdrew from Kherson. Ukrainian troops have now taken back their city, and we're beginning to hear these horrifying stories from the residents who remain there about what life was like under Russian occupation. And I'd just be curious about your reaction to what you're hearing.
It's a remarkable set of accomplishments for Ukrainian forces. It's a thing to celebrate, but we're not close to the end of this horrible war. And I think viewers and listeners who are following events in Ukraine closely need to brace themselves for the possibility of a war that drags on for many months, if not years to come. And that's a very horrible thing to contemplate.
Yes.
But I'm afraid that we have not seen the Russians' military effort collapse, and some very tough months still lie ahead.
Are you surprised? And Jeffrey Gettleman from the New York Times was telling us at the beginning of the hour about what the residents of Kherson were talking about, what life was like, again, you know, under Russian occupation, but the amount of abuse and torture that was meted out on the population. Andrew, does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. If you draw a straight line from what happened in World War II and the actions of the Soviet Red Army as it moved westward onto Berlin, and you look at the way the Russian military has performed in places like Afghanistan or Chechnya, the stories we're hearing out of Ukraine are all very much of the same pattern. The question that the world is going to have to confront is what kind of accountability will there be? Clearly, the people of Ukraine are going to try to get accountability for Russia's decision makers and trigger pullers, but getting that is going to be extremely hard, given that we all know that Russia is a nuclear armed power as well as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. So getting accountability is going to be extremely difficult.
Dara, let me go back to you. We're talking war crimes, correct?
Yes, we are. We are seeing a really kind of systemic attempt at intimidating the population, trying to break their capacity to resist, break up, what the Russians might consider partisan networks. It's just really harassment against all civilians that they suspect of being sympathetic to their own country, their own government. It is what surprised me about it was that these aspects were there from the very beginning of the war. It wasn't like this is a several year grueling war, an existential threat against Moscow. These kind of actions happened within days upon entry into Ukraine. And it's really not just a situation of, you know, okay, well, this one unit was bad, but the others are mostly okay. No, it's happening at different levels in pretty much everywhere the Russians are occupying. And the more the Ukrainians recover, the more likely we are to see these kind of atrocities be unearthed.
To you, Andrew, and you mentioned the fact that it looks like this war will drag on for months, if not years. But when you look at it today, can we say that Russia is losing, or is that the wrong kind of language to use when describing what's happening in Ukraine?
I would break it down into a couple of different pieces. Russia's conventional military, the ground units that it's using, as well as the forces it's using to conduct these horrible airstrikes against Ukraine's civilian infrastructure and power grid, that military capacity is being shredded. And Russia is running out of troops. It's running out of military armored vehicles to conduct a ground war in Ukraine. And it's running out of the precision-guided munitions that you would use to target things on the ground in Ukraine. The problem is the maximalist goals that Vladimir Putin has outlined, which are regime change, bringing Ukraine forcibly back into Russia's orbit, and annexing huge sections of Ukraine's territory. None of those maximalist goals have been jettisoned. And the Russians are famous, if you go back to history, of outlasting Napoleon, outlasting Hitler. Their goal here is simply that they can absorb more punishment and continue to fight. That's going to be hard from the standpoint of regenerating those conventional military capabilities that Dara is a far better expert on than I am. But it doesn't necessarily mean that tomorrow Putin's going to wake up and say, oh, this was a horrible mistake, I'm really sorry, and sneak out of Ukraine with his tail between his legs.
In fact, what you're saying is that he's going to stay and try to win this thing.
Yeah, and he's betting that time's on his side. I think he's wrong about that. But, you know, the big bet that he's making is that the West is either going to get to, at some point, you know, we'll be facing pressure from our societies because the cost of the war for the European economy, for the U.S. economy, is too great. And then his big bet, of course, is that you could have a new U.S. president elected in 2024, someone like Donald Trump. And we all can remember that in 2016, Donald Trump threw Ukraine under the bus when he was a presidential candidate. So the Russians pin their hopes on a lot of these things. They're engaged in a process of trial and error. And every time they try something, so far it hasn't worked out, they move on to the next thing. But that's their big bet.
And that is Andrew Weiss, who joins us along with Dara Masico. We are talking about the war in Ukraine. We began by talking about the liberation of Kherson in Ukraine. Of course, there is much more left to discuss and talk about. And you can join us. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the fact that Russian forces retreated from the city of Kherson last week, a significant victory for Ukraine. Today we're talking about where this war is headed after months of costly fighting, what a cold winter could mean for Ukraine, Russia, and Europe, what Putin's options are, as it looks like his military continues to suffer losses. And again, talking with Dara Masico, senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. She was previously senior analyst for Russian military capabilities at the Department of Defense. Andrew Weiss is with us as well, vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of Accidental Tsar, The Life and Lies of Vladimir Putin. And that's a new graphic biography of President Vladimir Putin of Russia, of course. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dara, let me read a comment from Kate, who asks, will the U.S. and others start to provide Ukraine with the means to stop aggression from the sky? Why haven't we already? What does Ukraine need in order to defend itself against Russia?
Well, as we're seeing again today, Russia has just launched another large wave of missiles against Ukrainian civilian infrastructure. They tend to do this a few days after a major setback. They did it in September after the collapse in Kharkiv. They did it in October after the Kerch Bridge was, span of it was blown, and again a few days after leaving Kherson. So at this point, Ukrainian air defense systems are allegedly shooting down a lot of Russian cruise missiles that are flying maybe low and slow, but their inventory is limited. It's going to be difficult to resupply Russian or Soviet origin surface-to-air missile systems over time. The United States and our allies don't produce that material. It came from Russia. Some of our NATO allies who are former Warsaw Pact members may have some inventory. But really, I think there's been a recent shift for those countries who are able. They're providing Ukraine with a small number of air defense systems that can provide some type of shield, maybe to a few cities like Kyiv. These are not large systems that can range out several hundred kilometers and intercept missiles. They're very close in terms of their reach, but it's better than nothing. I think that's the major issue moving forward. I don't see Russia stopping these attacks unless they are stopped, or their missiles run out internally, or Ukraine can shoot them down.
But I mean, it sounds like Ukraine is getting some military weapons to defend itself, but it needs more. Why isn't the West doing more for Ukraine, knowing that if Russia prevails in this war, the impact on Europe and even the United States is enormous?
Well, I think there's a capacity problem. There's not, by my understanding, I don't know how many available surface-to-air air defense systems are really available. That's not really an area of my expertise, so I don't want to misspeak on it, but I think that there is a limitation in the number that can be provided. For example, in the United States, we don't actually have that many Patriot air defense systems worldwide that would be able to defend against dozens or hundreds of Russian missiles over a sustained amount of time in Ukraine. So I think that there is a sort of a global inventory problem here.
Andrew, Rick says the Russian people are good. Putin is a psychopath. The people are not behind him, and he is losing a war of attrition. Are the people behind him, from what you can tell?
I wish your listener was right about that. There are a couple of challenges we all face in getting good data right now about the state of how the Russian public view the war. But the data we do have indicates that support has been running north of 70%.
Wow. There's
now, since September 21st, when Putin announced that he was drafting people into the war, there's been a breakdown of that support, because average Russians think that their husbands and brothers and children might be sucked into the vortex. But we've seen no manifestations of significant grassroots opposition or splits within the Russian elite. It's the latter that really matters here, because, as we all know, Russia is not a democracy. Putin's not up for re-election, and the Russian people do not get a vote, unfortunately, over who their leader is.
Does the West understand Vladimir Putin? You wrote this graphic novel biography of the Russian leader, who you say at the very beginning of the book, how did an undistinguished KGB police officer become one of the most powerful leaders in Russian history? What's the source of his power?
Vladimir Putin's had a great run as Russia's leader, and so you need to give the man his due. But from the very beginning, much of the image that people have of him as super spy, this master strategist, and this cunning global mastermind is really belied by a series of failures, as well as a level of emotionalism and impulsivity. So if you just one second, I'll tell you, the story that begins the book, literally on the first pages, is of a young KGB operative who's been waiting 10 years to go overseas. This is a scene in the early 1980s. And Putin, while he's in this training program waiting for his first overseas assignment after a series of sort of bench warmer roles in the bowels of the KGB, he gets into a street fight on a subway car and breaks his arm. And shortly after that, he's basically pushed out of this training program after only 1 year, and he's sent to a backwater assignment in East Germany, in Dresden, where he's in a tiny villa with six other operatives. This is not someone who was ever a high flyer. And then we've seen now on three occasions, in 2004, in 2014, and now with this horrible war in 2022, Ukraine has this magical hold on him, and his impulsivity and his emotional attachment to it has led him to make worse and worse decisions. And for people to sort of lose sight of that makes us then kind of assume that Putin kind of is rational or will make the right decision to recognize defeat. And I fear that that may not be the way this is all heading.
In fact, you say he's really driven by resentment and grievance.
Yeah, Putin, one of the best, I think, panels in the whole book, which was drawn by a Philly-based indie comics genius named Brian Brown, is this depiction of Putin's brain. And it came to me from a senior Western diplomat. And the diplomat explained how the problem when you're talking to Putin is there are these three sectors of his brain. The first one is all the garbage that's poured into it by the Russian intelligence services and the career bureaucracy, its conspiracies and all this nonsense that is, you know, kind of hall of mirrors. Second is the stuff that he himself has been involved in for 20 plus years as Russia's leader, and all the grievances and deals and other things he's been directly involved with, but this real sense that the West is out to get him. And then lastly is the real world, the world that we all deal with and that we read about by listening to the reading the newspaper or listening to the radio. The problem when you're talking to Putin is he toggles back and forth constantly among these three hemispheres, and you never really know which part of his brain he's in when he's talking to you. It makes him a very maddening person to deal with.
And you have talked to him, correct?
Yeah, at the beginning of Putin's time in the senior ranks of the Russian leadership, I was a staffer at the White House. And Putin, in rapid succession, moved from being National Security Advisor to Prime Minister to President Designate. And we dealt with him a great deal during this period. And it was a different Putin. It was a person who was far less sure of himself. It was a person who obviously had a huge stature gap between himself as a kind of nobody from the middling ranks of the KGB versus Bill Clinton, who was at that point in his second term and, you know, a very prominent force on the world stage. But what was visible even then, and there's a scene about this in the book, was this emotionalism. And the very last phone call that I participated in between Bill Clinton and Vladimir Putin when I was listening in, Putin just lost it and exploded at the president when Bill Clinton raised something that Russia was doing in a neighboring country. It suggested to me back then, and I think we continue to see illustrations of this, that there's times when President Putin lets his emotions get the best of him. And that's part of why President Biden is so worried about escalation and why the threat of nuclear weapons use or other dangerous scenarios cannot be completely ignored.
Well, let me toss that to you, Dara. We are talking about a country with nuclear weapons, and one wonders whether a desperate and cornered Putin might resort to using some kind of nuclear weapons. And I'd just be curious about how you see those calculations.
You know, I ever since maybe the late summer, I've been thinking about how Russia could escalate, what levers they have left to pull on if there was some sort of major collapse along their front line. Putin, as Andrew pointed out, he's gone all in on this war and yet didn't really resource the military properly from the beginning. They've faced incredible losses to their army, their airborne forces. It will take them years to recover. So what do they really have left? They have a lot of tools that they haven't used that aren't nuclear that they haven't used. You know, they haven't really retaliated against the West for the munitions that we're providing, the weapon systems we're providing for Ukraine, or really any of the planning support that's being discussed or intelligence support that's being discussed in various outlets. I think that's a fear that if they escalate maybe in space against NATO or United States specifically our satellites, that we would retaliate in some way, and that's uncontrolled. And so I see time and again, you know, when there's decision points, when the Russians, you know, theoretically a military planner would have recommended something like mobilization, Putin, I think, has kicked the can on that. It was obvious to several of us who watched the Russian military pretty closely that if mobilization was going to help them, they probably should have done it in maybe April or May. But they delayed that decision as long as possible for political reasons. So I'm of two minds here on the question of escalation. I see this pattern in the war where the Kremlin does not want to expand this to beyond Ukraine. But I also see another side when they're confronted with a sort of chaos that they don't anticipate, like the collapse up in Kharkiv up in September. They lash out. They lash out with annexing territory that they didn't control fully. They lashed out by ordering this mobilization and not really preparing for it. So I worry, based on the state of morale, how poorly the troops are being led, that if there is another large-scale collapse, I worry about what Andrew was talking about, this like emotional response of it's basically a question of how do I punish Ukraine for resisting me? And that is something I, as an analyst, struggle to predict, because that's a mindset But, you know, from what I know of the Russian military and how they think about nuclear escalation triggers, there's nothing that the Ukrainian military can do against Moscow that would trigger what they have declared to be reasons to use nuclear weapons, like attacking Russia in this massive way, attacking Russian nuclear weapons, attacking, you know, Russian satellites in space. Ukraine does not possess those capabilities.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's important to reiterate when Russia is starting to use these vague terms about using nuclear weapons. Ukraine doesn't pose those type of risks to Russia. They can't.
I hear you. Let me read an email from Stephen. Andrew, I'll put this to you. He says, was Putin's decision to conquer Ukraine based in part on his belief that the U.S. would not support Ukraine, as demonstrated by the Trump administration, and in particular, then-President Trump's express admiration for Putin? And if I can add something else to that, just my own question about whether the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan somehow gave Putin this sort of green light when it came to Ukraine.
The world came really close to war back in spring of 2021 when Russia massed forces on the border, and then it backed off. But when the Kremlin witnessed the withdrawal of U.S. forces and the rapid collapse of the Ghani government in Afghanistan, I think they made a pattern-matching mistake and assumed that a U.S.-backed regime like the Afghan government, if you put pressure on it, would simply crumble and the people wouldn't fight or defend their country. The other part of this is Putin has a long history of being very opportunistic and improvising and moving really nimbly and quickly. So it was the combination of watching what happened in Afghanistan, the departure of German leader Angela Merkel from the political scene, which made him think Europe would be more divided. And then lastly, the fact that the Zelensky government in 2021 was in a series of self-inflicted crises. So Putin felt this was the moment to go, and it was going to be a time when Russia's advantages were at their highest. It was much more likely over time that the U.S. continued military support for Ukraine and other types of Western cooperation was just going to make the job harder. But as Dara said a minute ago, he miscalculated. He didn't put the right amount of forces in place to carry out such an audacious invasion.
We're almost out of time here, but Andrew, a question for you. Is there a place for diplomacy, or does that have to wait?
It's not the time for diplomacy right now. It's fine to keep the door open. It's fine to show that if the Russians were ever reasonable and serious about diplomacy, that people are willing to talk to them. The big problem is that over the past 8 years of this war, the Russians have never demonstrated good faith. They've basically tried to play for time. They've tried to wait the Ukrainians out. They've tried to plant wedges in the West and basically hope that this, you know, that the Western coalition backing Ukraine will have ADHD and lose interest. And that so far, unfortunately, is still the case today.
And Dara, how do you see that?
I see that, the demands from Moscow are unacceptable to Ukraine, and Ukraine has put some conditions out there that Russia is not probably going to accept either. So I really agree with Andrew that, you know, neither side is ready to stop the fighting, although I'm sure, you know, both sides want the fighting to stop. But I don't see the groundswell yet.
And meanwhile, we see the suffering, Dara, of the Ukrainian people.
We do. And unfortunately, I mean, it's terrible, but it's baked into Russian strategies. These strikes that we're seeing to, you know, disable Ukrainians' power grid, water treatment. So I suspect we'll see strikes on fuel depots or sewage treatment. It's really to make life so unbearable for citizens that it or grind the gears of the Ukrainian government to a halt or prevent their military from getting fuel for their vehicles. It's just really dialing up the suffering and the misery. And now we're seeing that happen going into winter.
Indeed, we are. Dara Masico, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. Andrew Weiss, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Really appreciate the chance to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of Accidental Czar. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.